Newsmart, sponsored in part by American Express. I'm Bill Lynch, CBS News. This week, a moral dilemma.
I was told that this building had once stabled 80 horses. There were 1,200 men in it, five to a bunk. The stink was beyond all description. As we walked out into the courtyard, a man fell dead. Two others, they must have been over 60, were crawling towards the latrine. I saw it, but will not describe it.
April 15th, 1945. The war is over, and for the first time, the world looks into Nazi Germany's factories of death. Edward R. Murrow was the first to report the liberation of Buchenwald.
Professor Riescher said, perhaps I would care to see the small courtyard. I said yes. The wall was about 8 feet high. It adjoined what had been a stable or garage. We entered. It was floored with concrete. There were two rows of bodies stacked up like cordwood. They were thin and very white. Some of the bodies were terribly bruised, though there seemed to be little flesh to bruise. Some had been shot through the head, but they bled but little. All except two were naked. I tried to count them as best I could and arrived at the conclusion that all that was mortal of more than 500 men and boys lay there in two neat piles. It appeared that most of the men and boys had died of starvation. They had not been executed. But the manner of death seemed unimportant. Murder had been done at Buchenwald.
Not all of the Nazi victims starved to death. Not all of the victims were led to the gas chambers and the ovens. At Dachau, near Munich, people were frozen to death in the name of science.
And they took them to the point of death, or practically to the point of death, cooled them down until they were unconscious, almost unconscious, and then tried to rewarm them in various methods.
Robert Pozos is director of the Hypothermia Laboratory at the University of Minnesota School of Medicine in Duluth.
The real question is, you know, you see somebody fall into off of a boat here in Lake Superior. How long can they stay out there? How cold can they get before they're really in trouble? How cold can they, what physiologically is happening there? What's the best way to rewarm the severely hypothermic individual who's not drunk, who's not on drugs, who's not physically compromised? That's, I mean, a very big question.
How to rewarm a frozen person? A big question with lives in the balance. The Nazi doctors sought to answer that question. They wanted to save the lives of Luftwaffe pilots downed in the North Sea. The Nazi doctors knew no moral or legal boundaries. Did they, in their experiments at Dachau, learn something that could help Dr. Pozos save lives today?
When I give talks, they always bring up these questions. What's the best way to do this? Or didn't the Nazis show this or that? And it was about a year ago, I said, that's enough. After one person asked me too many times, I just said, well, I'm going to find out.
Dr. Pozos obtained a long-suppressed U.S. Army synopsis of the Nazi hypothermia experiments. Reading the report was as chilling as the subject at hand. It raised immediate ethical issues.
Well, what do you do with this data? Should you present it to a public audience? Let's say you have a Polish person in there whose mother or father died in Dachau, or a Jewish person, or a Gypsy person. I mean, it was a question that I had never really addressed. But, you know, I didn't mean, all of a sudden it just, for some reason, jumped out at me. And that's when I asked, Art Kaplan, what was the ethics behind it? And he basically said, who knows, you know.
Arthur Kaplan is director of the University of Minnesota Center for Biomedical Ethics.
Pozos' dilemma is that he is interested in two things. How long can a person survive exposed to cold, people of different size and weight wearing different clothing? The only people who have put that to the human test were the Nazis. He can't replicate it. He won't replicate it. He's certainly aware of and endorses and believes in the contemporary standards of ethics that prevail today in human experimentation. So he's not going to take people even into the near risk situation. The second issue is the Germans came up with various techniques that they said were useful for resuscitating people who had been exposed to cold. Pozos isn't going to try those experiments either. But should he use that information? Should he go to the original source to see whether what they say worked actually did work and whether we should put any stock in it at all?
We'll discuss Robert Pozos' dilemma when our Newsmart broadcast continues in a moment.
The hookless fastener company had been through hard times. A previous model on women's skirts had shredded their petticoats. But now the fastener was being tested by a galoshes company. And when the company president tried it, he joyfully shouted the words that gave this fastener its name. Can you guess what it is? To button up and snap together all your travel plans, there's United Airlines and the American Express card. United serves more of the U.S. than any other airline, and the American Express card lets you charge travel expenses. No wonder frequent business flyers rate the card best for their travel and entertainment. Now, when the company president shoved his feet into the galoshes and slid the fasteners up, he shouted, "Zipper up!" And suddenly the name Zipper entered the English language. United, come fly the friendly skies.
The girl I jumped in after was hanging on to the rope that they dropped to her, and she just gave out, let go.
January 13th, 1982. An Air Florida 737 crashes into the Potomac River. And if you watched the evening news, you saw a classic example of the effects of hypothermia.
The Park Service helicopter, whose pilot did one of the most incredible jobs of flying I have ever seen, managed to keep that helicopter right over her, and they lowered a life ring and put that life ring right in front of her face. And she seemed dazed, too dazed to reach out and touch the ring that could save her life.
The example that was shown, I think, was where this individual was trying to hold on to a raft, a donut-shaped device that was hooked up to a helicopter. Eventually, you lose the ability to use your arms and your legs, and that was classically demonstrated there. And that's primarily thought to be due to the fact that the cold influences the nerves in your arms on a local level, just numbs them so that you lose the ability to actually move your fingers first, and then eventually you can't even move your arm out of the water, or there's no muscle strength there.
The woman in the Potomac, an Air Florida stewardess, was saved when a bystander plunged into the frozen river to pull her to safety. Much of what we know today about rescuing hypothermia victims is the result of trial and error performed in hospital emergency rooms. Dr. Robert Pozos has studied emergency room records looking for clues.
The real question is, how do you warm them up? What's the best way to rewarm somebody? Well, there's many ways. You can microwave people. You can use warm blankets. You can use warm fluids. You can induce warm fluid into their body cavities, whether it's through the peritoneum, the rectum, urinary bladder. You can do a coronary bypass. There's tons of ways. You name it, and people have thought of it, of how to rewarm somebody. You can use hot bathtubs, body-to-body rewarming. All these techniques have been used, and all these techniques have been used with a certain amount of lack of scientific critical thinking.
Some victims are saved, others are lost. There is simply no scientific way to study the treatment of hypothermia victims. That brings Dr. Pozos and us to the results of the Nazi experiments at Dachau.
It is like everything else in science. One piece of data, one report by itself doesn't mean much, but it's, as you know, it's a compilation of the Dachau data gathered from Canada, data gathered from London, data gathered from elsewhere that fits in with a whole pattern that we look at.
But should the Nazi data be looked at?
In terms of looking at data gathered from these experiments, it's really interesting to see how humans respond to cold temperature and rates of fall. On the other hand, I don't like the way the data was gathered. I have real trouble with that. But there's no other way to get it, so I'm over there. I'm sort of, yes, I want it, but no, I don't want it.
Is it possible to transform or redeem something good from what is clearly evil?
Arthur Kaplan says that ethically, everything about the Dachau data is wrong.
The people who ran these experiments violated all norms of decency, certainly all norms of human experimentation, even which prevailed at that time.
But no matter how wrongfully the data was collected, it does exist.
There are some who would say these experiments are so bad that they never should be looked at, they should never be discussed, and that should be the end of it. There are others who would say it would be a further insult to the memory of those who died to throw away information that might have value, that you should try to redeem or transform this terrible activity and get something good out of it.
We will open this moral Pandora's box when our Newsmark broadcast continues in a moment.
For the past 4 years, Copley Los Angeles newspapers have been listening to you. Through phone surveys, focus groups, interviews, and exit polls, we've been asking you, the people of the West Side, what you want in your newspaper. What you said is you want more news about you and your town. We listen. If you haven't seen the Outlook lately, take a look. You'll find more about you and your town. Culver City, Venice, Marina Del Rey, and all the great towns on the West Side. The Outlook staff of fine reporters is now larger than ever before, better able to cover you and your town. World and national news is still very important to the content of the Outlook, and you've let us know it's important to you, too. But our studies show that you're sending Deborah Austin, managing editor of the Outlook, on a mission to give you, the West Side, what you want. Start reading more about you and your town today. Call 828-5008. That's 828-5008 to start your personal newspaper.
So we come to Dr. Pozzo's dilemma. Scientific data exists. Data from experiments that cannot be reproduced in any ethical society. Data that could save human lives. Data that is morally tainted. Do we use it or do we ignore it? David Rothman is director of the Center for Study of Society in Medicine and professor of medical ethics at Columbia University in New York. Nancy Dubler is an attorney and director of the Division of Legal and Ethical Issues at New York's Montefiore Medical Center. Robert Lifton is distinguished professor of psychiatry and psychology at John Jay College and also author of the book Nazi Doctors. And Mark Weitzman is associate director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, which is devoted to the study of the Holocaust. Nancy Dubler, for the sake of argument, let's assume that the data is valid, that the experiments were well conducted and followed the appropriate scientific methods. Assuming all of that, is there any doubt in your mind as to how we ought to approach this material now, 45 years later?
I think that whatever benefit we might derive from this research, I would suggest that the dangers from including it and verifying it's part of a reputable scientific community would outweigh the benefits. And therefore, at least as a preliminary position, I would suggest that it not be used.
Dr. Rothman.
Nancy, I'm not sure if I agree or disagree, but let me pose a question back to you. Whatever we decide about the Nazi case, I think it's a case of one. And probably, as been said, the data is not terrific. Are we now... And we do regulate our own research. Are we now to set up a standard that we will look behind the ethics of research anywhere in this world? If South African research is conducted in a way that offends our sensibilities, should American publications refuse to publish it? Should we refuse to cite it? Should we refuse to read the South African journal? If in Argentina, under the military, horrendous experiments take place, and let's, for sake of argument, say that they prove interesting results, do we not cite them? Do we not cite the researchers? In the end, is there something inevitably somewhat amoral about the scientific process?
Well, I think we have the obligation to look at, in the same way that Professor Lifton has raised the connection between the moral stature of investigators and the quality of their scientific information, I think that's an appropriate question to ask.
Dr. Lifton.
I want to say that we have to resist the amoral impulse of science always. And this is one way. And here I would say one answer is never use this research as ordinary scientific research just to be cited and put in a journal. If you use it at all, it has to be a total expose of exactly what was done, and then you can evaluate everything, including the quality of the conclusions. But it has to be evaluated as a moral aberration and condemned in that evaluation. That was, in a way, the spirit with which I conducted my study of Nazi doctors. I want to know what they did and what they were like. I want to grasp their motivations, but from the standpoint of exposing immoral behavior, indeed evil. And I think that's the perspective from which one could look at this work, including its conclusions.
And in no way, I should think, would we want to publish or use this material in any way that would enhance their stature professionally or in any other fashion.
I mean, you could hypothesize, which I don't think possible, but the extreme situation of you've studied the work, you find that it's the only work that gives you certain valuable conclusions which would save lives, and you're absolutely certain that it's valid. Now, I don't think any of those things are true, but if they were, then of course, I would say, of course you use it and you save lives, but you never forget how it was derived, and you write an expose of the whole thing, including its conclusions and the condemnation of the entire process. But I don't think that pertains, because I don't think you would find it so indispensable.
Mark Weitzman.
Well, I think that that raises the whole issue, and this relates in some ways more to the Holocaust directly than to the scientific effort involved, in the sense of how much we're willing to say that the past should not be buried, how much we're willing to say that we have to learn from the past, and how, and its applicability, not just to a particular group, to a particular time, but overall, it the Pandora's box is open, the fact is out. The question is, what kind of people, what kind of researchers, what kind of doctors, what kind of technicians, et cetera, are going to be dealing with this material? And that is where a broad moral sense comes in. And that is a goal that has to be dealt with.
We will examine in more detail how this material might be able to be used when Newsmart continues after this.
If you want to succeed in business, here are some excellent reasons why you should subscribe to the Wall Street Journal. Every business day, the Journal covers all the financial markets, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, you name it. The Journal keeps you up to date on what's happening in real estate, technology, small business, and personal finance. The Journal tells you about the latest marketing trends and developments, mergers and acquisitions, what's new in international trade. The Journal also keeps you informed about presidential politics and government policy. If you want to succeed in business, aren't those reasons enough why you should subscribe to the Journal? The world of business is moving fast, so keep up. You can subscribe to the Wall Street Journal now. Take advantage of the Journal's great subscription offer. 13 weeks, just $29.75. Only $29.75 for 13 weeks of the Journal delivered to your home or office every business day. To order, call toll-free in the continental U.S., 800-228-6600. That's 800-228-6600 for the Wall Street Journal.
Returning now, I'd like to ask Nancy Dubler, who's a medical ethicist at Montefiore Medical Center in New York, what format, what approach should be taken, assuming that a researcher such as Dr. Pozzo would like to use this material, how ought he or she to be restricted?
Well, I think there are two parts to the answer to that question. One is in relationship to the material that we're discussing in specific, which is the material from Nazi Germany, on which, by and large, the world has reached a decision in terms of the moral and intellectual quality of that research, and if it's used at all, and if it could be critical for the saving of human lives, it must be used acknowledging the moral flaw in the process by which it was gathered. But the second part to that answer, it seems to me, relates to the question that Dr. Rothman raised at the outset, which is, how should we deal with possibly questionable data or tainted data in the present? What about data that's collected by the jailers in a repressive regime or in the gold mines of South Africa? And I would argue that the important lesson from this data is that we do have a moral obligation to question scientific data, number one, and the scientific personalities that produce that data for their own benefit and for the benefit of others, number two. So I would argue that the lesson is that we have an ongoing obligation to question data, especially in societies where the protection for human subjects and the protections for informed consent and informed choice may be questionable.
Let me ask you, follow up on that a little bit. What about the distinction between the researcher also being the victimizer and the case where the victim, as in prisoners of war from Korea and Vietnam, for example, is then later studied by American doctors to test the limits of whatever pain or illness or endurance he may have had? Is that exploiting that person's suffering in a different way?
Maybe I could speak to that, because I've done a lot of work with both groups, mostly work with victims until recently when I studied Nazi doctors or perpetrators. But you know, there's a moral dimension either way. And the moral dimension really includes reconstructing what really happened to human beings. What was done to human beings by other human beings becomes part of a moral and an intellectual question. And maybe one conclusion is that intellectual results should never be totally separate from moral evaluation in any situation, no matter how pure the claim of science.
Dr. Rothman.
You know, it's interesting, because without giving our country too many kudos, I think it's fair to say that there is no nation in the world which does a better job at the moment of protecting the human subjects of experimentation than we do. But we are way ahead. And Nancy Dubler can say we've got to question the data, but Nancy, that's a bit, that's too, one always questions the data.
I don't think researchers question the moral basis of the data.
I think there's this mythology of science and the objective facts standing by itself that has never been explored.
But wait, you're sliding off easily. What do you mean question the data? Yes, look, you know the nature of the enterprise. Are you really going to come out and say, look, one doesn't have to talk just South Africa. The English do not regulate human experimentation the way we do. They actually ran, they wanted to know about electroshock. And they set up a control group. Yeah. And they actually put some people under anesthesia to maintain the scientific purity, something which we would never do. Do we not publish that data? Not cite that data?
I think we are capable as a society and as researchers of dealing with nuance. And I think there is a difference between research that comes out of a society which generally respects human beings and respects human rights on the one hand. But more than that, I think there are societies in which respect for human beings is not the guiding principle of that society. And in those societies, I think there is a far greater obligation.
In regard to the scientist doing what he or she is doing, in using the data, you'd have to really evoke the way in which it was gathered. And that becomes part of your evaluation of the result. So if there's torture done by South Africans or Argentinians, as indeed was done, they might not have done it as an experiment, but still we might want to learn what they did to human beings and the effect of what they did on human beings. You have to include what was done and the whole structure, the whole description of that environment as part of your evaluation of the whole issue.
I just think it's important to reiterate at various points in this discussion that information is not value neutral. Somehow, we as a society have come to think of scientific information as standing on its own and unchallengeable. That's not true. And the value component in how research is designed, how data are gathered, how they are analyzed, how the design is constructed, are all part of the ongoing necessity to evaluate that information.
Nancy, I'm not, you know, what you're arguing, I wish it were true, I'm not persuaded it's true. What you're arguing is that ultimately, good science is inexorably linked to good ethics. What you're really suggesting is that in the end, if it's really first-rate science, it's going to be first-rate ethics. I wish that were true, I'm not persuaded.
There's a more subtle model than just that. I mean, it's partly true. I think that science and ethics are bound together. You can't separate them and isolate them in pure form. However, their relationship may not be one-to-one.
But, Bob, you know, the trouble is the stakes get higher.
Yeah.
Saul Krugman purposefully infects the Willowbrook residents, an institution for the retarded, with hepatitis virus in order to be able to study more about hepatitis. It was crummy ethics to understate the point, although he had his rationales. I don't want to go into those now. But it turned out to be pretty good science. Helps us in the end. He doesn't make the great breakthrough. That's Barry Blumberg. But in the end, he comes out with some really important findings. I'm not sure you can so easily distinguish, you know, ethics from the results of science.
In a certain way, aren't you basically almost coming down to an ends justifies the means, in which you're saying essentially, or using the Nazi model again, that we are giving them a post facto justification and absolving them, a vindication in a sense, of some of their methodology and some of their things, because the final result, there was one item of fact that might turn out to be useful and positive.
The nightmare to the historian would be that 100 years from now, somebody says, oh yes, they killed 6 million Jews, but they did discover, after all, the cure for X. I mean, that's the nightmare sentence.
And that's what I think we're all on guard for.
Well, and if we can wrap up, because we're running low on time, I gather from this discussion that it would probably be a safe bet to say, in your behalf, and stop me if I'm wrong, that if Dr. Pozos can derive some scientific benefit to mankind from these materials, then, and if he proceeds in a responsible, narrowly construed way and makes clear where his research is coming from, assuming there's some benefit there.
But not narrowly construed. In other words, you have to broaden your construction. Right. And it's the opposite in the sense, well, he has to reconstruct how those experiments were done in order for him to validly, morally and intellectually use the work.
I think that's what I meant to say. But given those conditions, nobody here has a big problem.
I do.
With it.
I okay. would still argue that unless there was extraordinary benefit, mm-hmm. which could not be...
How do you measure that?
I don't think he's invalid. From everything we've learned...
I think that there is an overriding moral obligation to make a judgment on that research, which as far as I know, as far as I can tell, would outweigh the utility of those data. And so I would argue they should not be.
Well, I agree with that. In other words, I think that we haven't reached the point where we can say it's at all justified for him to use that data. I haven't really seen a careful evaluation of what worth it has given those conditions, the conditions carefully elaborated. And I haven't either seen how valuable whatever conclusion might come from that would be for other people in saving lives. And until I saw those two things in a very clear-cut way, I would also say don't use it.
I would also
rather expose it.
I would also have similar qualms in that if the material has been published and bits and pieces have been published so far, etc., that's one thing. To go back, to reenact it, to delve into that again, I'm not sure, because the entire process, as Professor Lipton has described, is full of corruption. I'm not sure of the value to that, especially weighed in the in light of giving this sort of activity a justification, both in the past for Nazi doctors and Nazi medicine, and for the present and for the future in repressive regimes and totalitarian regimes throughout the world. I think that there are a lot of qualms. It's opening up a Pandora's box.
And last word from Dr. Rothman.
Whatever we do in this particular case, I don't want it easily bracketed and dismissed, and that's what we did with the Nazis. This is not the end of the story of the problems in human experimentation, and the degree of care and caution that we do here, we ought to be thinking about in terms of the ongoing problems, thankfully not in this country, but in many other countries whose research we use.
Thank you.
Maybe a bit here, too.
Thank you very much. David Rothman of Columbia University, Nancy Dubler, Director of Legal and Ethical Issues at Montefiore Medical Center, Robert Lifton of John Jay College in New York, and Mark Weitzman, Associate Director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center. In a moment, we'll have a word about next week's Newsmark.
The following is a paid political announcement.
Paid for by Californians Against Unfair Tax Increases, a committee of the tobacco industry.
I like to come out here and sit in my garden when I need to get some really serious thinking done. Like right now. Oh, I don't know. I'm feeling sort of betrayed. You see, some months back, I saw that petition for a tax proposition on the November ballot, and I almost signed it. The promoter said it would tax tobacco to raise money for health research. Well, I'm glad I didn't sign it, because it turns out that research would get only pennies of each dollar. Biggest chunk would go to the promoters behind the proposition. Well, I think that's a self-serving ripoff. Particularly since most of the money from that November tax proposition would come from working people. Well, I was almost tricked into signing that petition, but I'm voting against that tricky tax proposition come November.
Next week on Newsmark, CBS News health specialist Dr. Peter Salgo will examine a different dilemma. What can we eat? As each day it seems we are warned that yet another grocery item poses some new health hazard. This week's Newsmark, Dr. Pozo's Moral Dilemma, was produced by Richard Stapleton, assistant producer Evelyn Lee, assistant of the producers Kathleen Quillen. The senior producer of Newsmark is Norman Morris, executive producers Joseph Dembo and Dick Reeves. And I'm Bill Lynch, CBS News.